Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. Are you tired of the endless cycle of dieting and the guilt that comes with it? Well, get ready to leave diet culture behind and embrace a revolutionary approach where no food is off limits. That's right, you heard it. No food is off limits. Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, author of Nutrivore, is here to share her refreshing, positive, and inclusive approach to nutrition, grounded in science and focused on nourishment, not judgment. In this revolutionary New York Times bestseller, you're going to learn how to make nutrient-dense choices within any preferred eating style. Unlike traditional diet books, Nutrivore is a guilt-free, science-based guide that shifts the focus to what truly matters, nutrients your body needs to thrive. Stay tuned. You're about to discover a personalized, flexible, and exciting way to think about food that's going to improve your health, vitality, and everyday life. Dr. Sarah is in the house, and it all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our next guest is a distinguished scientist and a visionary founder of Nutrivore.com. She's a renowned advocate for health and nutrition with a strong commitment to evidence-based science. She's dedicated her career to creating educational resources that empower people to make informed and sustainable diet and lifestyle choices. Her approach, rooted in nutrient density and sufficiency, emphasizes the importance of nourishment over judgment. She's a leading voice in immunity, gut, and metabolic health. Her latest book is the New York Times bestseller, Nutrivore, the radical new science for getting the nutrients you need from the food you eat. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sarah Ballantyne.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. I don't think I could have described the Nutrivore dietary philosophy any better.
Well, excellent. Yeah, so great to have you on the show. You know, I get so many authors on here, and it's eat this, not that, my way or the highway. And these books are so common, but Nutrivore really offers a unique way of eating. Share with us first the basis behind focusing on nutrients instead of specific food groups.
Well, a nutrient is a raw material that the body needs for all of the chemical reactions of life. And when you think about nutrients in that very basic way, right, it is a chemical that my body needs to do all of the things that my body does every single day. Like, of course, we need the nutrients from the foods we eat. And yet, that is not something that is integrated into most dietary templates. It's not an education that we get in school. Like, most people don't know what different nutrients do in the body, what types of foods have what types of nutrients, but that is the most basic function of nourishment, is to provide our body with all of the raw materials it needs to do all of the amazing things our bodies do. And so with Nutrivore, it's about shifting the conversation away from fear and restriction and all of the diet rules that we know don't work because it's not sustainable. We don't find ourselves sticking to those diets over the long term because we feel so deprived, and eventually we fall off the wagon and we start that whole cycle all over again. So leaving that sort of restrictive, dogmatic mindset in the past and really focusing on understanding what foods are nourishing us and still intentionally making room for foods that give us joy, even if they don't give us a lot of nutrients. So it's really about those raw materials and making sure we are meeting the daily demands of our body while giving ourselves permission to enjoy food, to celebrate with food, to bond over food, these natural sort of ingrained human experiences that make an overall healthy diet sustainable.
I love this saying, it's dieting is so hard because it has the word die in it. Who wants that? We want live. And you talk about live foods and whole foods. And I love that. Share with us this Nutrivore scoring system. It's so unique. And how can we benefit by simply following the numbers?
So nutrient density is scientifically defined as nutrients per calorie, but we don't really have a very good way of measuring that yet. So there's been lots of doctors, wellness influencers, educators in the past are talking about focusing on more nutrient-dense foods to get all of the nutrients that our bodies need. But how do we identify those? We can kind of look at a label and go, yeah, that looks like some good numbers. That must be nutrient-dense. Or we can actually develop an algorithm, a mathematical formula for calculating it and make that objective rather than subjective. And that's what the Nutrivore score attempts to do. It's a measurement of nutrients per calorie that includes 33 nutrients in the calculation. So it's a very robust way to measure, is this food giving me a lot of the essential raw materials that my bodies need per calorie? Yes, then that's a great food to incorporate in larger amounts. And is this food maybe delivering a lot more energy than it is essential nutrients? Sure, that doesn't mean we need to avoid that food or label that food as bad. It just means that that's a food that we want to moderate.
Right. You'd like to emphasize the importance of whole foods. And some people believe donuts and Cheerios are whole foods because they have holes in them. Not that kind of whole food, right? Share with us the definition of a whole food.
So I like a loosey-goosey definition of a whole food. I think technically we call any food that looks the way it is produced in nature, we call that whole. But I prefer a slightly blurrier definition, which is any food in which most of its inherent nutrients are intact. So that means a food can undergo some processing like freezing or canning. If you still have most of the nutrition inherent to those green beans, for example, which you do when you eat canned green beans, then in my book, that counts as a whole food since I'm really looking at, does this food still deliver the nutrients that it would have had if I had just picked it off the plant? Yes, sure. In that case, that processing doesn't matter. And if it makes that food cheaper and more convenient, then that's a bonus.
Yeah, I love what you said. I saw a video of you saying, you know, a lot of times these frozen are fresher and more healthier than the picked because it's got to travel from California to the East Coast. That's not fresh, correct? It's fresher if you capture it right there and freeze it in its whole form.
Yeah, it's different for different fruits and vegetables. So some fruits and vegetables, their nutrients are just more stable, so they can be stored for a very long time, right? Apples can be stored for months and not have much nutrient degradation, whereas something like leafy greens have more nutrients that are a little bit more volatile, and so they degrade a little bit faster through storage. So it kind of depends on exactly what food we're talking about. But frozen, typically those fruits and vegetables are frozen within about 24 hours of harvest. So you are locking in all of the nutrients, keeping them steady for your months or years maybe that those bags of frozen vegetables are in your freezer. So they're an excellent choice and they're often far cheaper than the fresh.
Yeah, so true. I know food debates have become almost as heated as political fights, but what I love about Nutrivore, it's not a diet. It's a tool for bipartisan dining. The vegans, the paleo, the keto followers can enjoy a Nutrivore lifestyle. What motivated you to adopt a no food off limits approach?
My own personal history with restrictive dieting and realizing over time that I had learned an eating disorder. That was a pretty crummy realization to go, holy smokes, I am afraid of foods that are actually healthy for me. And so I spent a lot of time digging into the research. I'm a person who needs to have that scientific understanding in order to move past my food fears, which is why I create a lot of content that cites all of that science to help other people have the knowledge that they need to move past food fears. But it was that realization that made me really think about how healthy diet is communicated these days on the internet. And it's very much, be afraid of this, don't eat this. And it's not what we avoid that makes us healthy or unhealthy. It's the foods that we're actually eating and whether or not those foods are supplying all of the nutrients, the raw materials our bodies need, that actually counts. And so how can we shift the conversation towards what are important foods to add and stop engaging with this restrictive mindset that drives food cravings, food obsession, food fixation, emotional eating, and dramatically increases the risk of developing eating disorders, as I accidentally found myself in that situation. How can we leave that sort of restrictive mindset behind?
Right. I know there's so many food myths out there. And like you, I'm also a myth buster. I'm curious, what common belief out there do you consider the worst one? The one that makes you roll your eyes and says, I can't believe I'm seeing this. Is there one specific that you're like, ugh?
That's a tough choice. I would say, so one of the ones that I used to believe, and I think because I bought into it, I'm extra passionate about busting this myth, is the myth that vegetable oils are toxic and inflammatory. When you look at the human studies, the well-controlled large clinical trials, the systematic reviews and meta-analyses that pool together all of the data from all of the well-designed studies so that you have even higher statistical power to be able to determine what the overall effect is, they really unequivocally show that vegetable oils reduce risk of cancer mortality, so dying from cancer. They reduce risk of cardiovascular disease incidence, cardiovascular disease mortality, type 2 diabetes incidence and all-cause mortality, which is a general indicator of health and longevity. That is completely contrary to, I feel like every fad diet likes to demonize vegetable oils now. It's kind of like the popular kid to bully in the playground. Like everybody wants in to say vegetable oils are sort of the root of all modern health problems. When the science shows the complete opposite of that, I feel like this is, you know, partly because we do want to something to blame, right? We do want to feel like the way that I gain control over my own health is by finding whoever is the culprit behind my health struggles. I have this one thing to blame. It feeds into a lot of distrust of big agriculture, the pharmaceutical industry, government regulations. So it can kind of tie into a lot of conspiracy theories and a lot of just earned, I think, in some ways, distrust that is out there. It feeds into, it sort of takes advantage of a very low level of like base knowledge that most people have about biology and biochemistry and how our bodies utilize nutrients and all the different metabolic pathways they're involved in. And then it feeds into our fears, right? And it sort of shows us, aha, you are right. But the science shows these are beneficial to include. We have several layers of different systems that are using these fats for different purposes. And overall, they don't increase inflammation. If anything, they slightly decrease inflammation. They're decreasing the risk of these big health problems. We would be healthier if we substituted saturated fats in our diet for vegetable oils. And so to me, it's in part because I used to believe it and I fell for it. That makes me extra more passionate. But also I think it's the food myth that is everywhere. It has been around for a really long time. It's seven layers deep on the internet. And it's one that just a lot of people aren't ready to hear. It's one that really gets big, big feelings stirred up.
Yeah. So I know the common do not consume list includes there's canola oil, we got soybeans, sunflower, cottonseed, corn, grapeseed, and safflower oils. Do these get a thumbs up approval from you, or is there a couple we should stay away from, or are they all on the okay list? They're all okay.
They're all okay. Not only that, there have been a bunch of really well-designed studies that pit canola oil against olive oil and show that they're approximately equally beneficial, and they should probably like share the podium for number one best fat that we can cook with at home, which is kind of crazy because olive oil has got this great PR team and poor canola oil has not benefited the same way. Meanwhile, the science shows that they're both excellent. And when it comes to cardiovascular disease risk factors, they seem to work a little bit differently, which means that their effects might be additive. So we would actually be healthier if we mixed it up and used both.
Very interesting. I know one myth that still makes my eyes roll, and I dealt with it yesterday with a patient. Medical doctors telling their patients, chew Tums so they can get the calcium they need to make strong bones. And Tums contains calcium carbonate, which requires acid stomach to be absorbed. So when you chew an antacid with calcium, the mineral doesn't make it to the bones. So it's so funny how, yeah, just chew Tums. That's your answer. And it's I just rolled my eyes. I said, no, it's a little bit more than that. Speaking of that, let me ask you about the dietary supplements. I know we share a lot of the same views to people go with supplements versus whole foods. You say foods are better than multivitamin. Explain why you're not a fan of the mindset of pill for your ill.
I mean, I wouldn't call myself anti-supplement. I believe there's a time and a place for supplements. But I think often we are sold supplements as a shortcut. And when it comes to multivitamins, we're sold supplements as nutritional insurance, right? We're sold multivitamins as don't worry about the quality of your diet. You can just get all the vitamins and minerals you need in this, you know, one tablet or this one capsule. But when you look at these really large studies that look at do multivitamins actually improve all-cause mortality as a just general indicator of whether or not something is benefiting us overall. If you look at cardiovascular disease, incidence of mortality, cancer, incidence of mortality, you don't see a signal of benefit from a daily multivitamin the way you do from when you get those nutrients from food. And I think there's some different possible explanations for this. I don't think we have a really strong answer from the medical literature yet as to why. Is it not enough? Do we need to formulate our vitamins and minerals differently to make up for a really nutrient insufficient diet? Are these nutrients poorly absorbed? There is some evidence to that effect. Are we missing something, right? Is there something really important that we get in a mainly whole foods diet that just isn't even included in these vitamins and minerals, right? There's lots of possible explanations for why we don't see a signal, but regardless, you would expect that if they were benefiting our health overall, and this isn't to say there's not other outcomes where there might be a benefit, right? So there's some interesting research showing B-complex vitamins can improve cognition in the elderly, right? There's always exceptions to these rules. But if we're just taking a multivitamin as nutritional insurance, the science says it's not actually doing anything and that money would be better spent on more whole foods or foods that are pre-prepared so that it makes it easier for us to cook at home and eat those higher quality, more nutrient-dense foods than it is on that pill a day that doesn't seem to be doing a whole lot.
No, well said. You know, like I said, if you have whole foods and you're lacking that, go with nutrition that contains whole foods. It's the same thing. And that way you can find stuff that herbs and stuff from nature rather than these chemicals and these fillers and binders that's so hard to digest. As you said, some of them don't even do anything. They go right through the body. You know, I've had so many guests recently. I want to get your view on this. They share the negative impact of natural food compounds like phytic acid, the oxalates, the lectin, especially the lectin. Oh, don't eat beans. Don't eat tomatoes. These are labeled as anti-nutrients, off limits, because they inhibit the absorption of important nutrients, supposedly. What's your take on these popular elimination diets? Should we stay away from beans and lentils and legumes?
All of those food substances, when we fearmonger around them as anti-nutrients, as soon as you look at the studies showing health benefits of the foods that contain the substances, like the foundation of the fearmongering starts to crumble. So legumes are one of the healthiest, like most important foods that we can include in our diets to support long-term health and reduce our risk of future health problems. Even just a couple of servings per week can reduce all-cause mortality by 20-25%. Whole grains, which are high in phytates, legumes are high in phytates, they reduce all-cause mortality risk. They reduce risk of cardiovascular disease thanks to all of the fiber they contain, but also potentially thanks to phytates. So here's a really cool fact is that phytates are very chemically similar to myo-inositol. Myo-inositol has been shown in a variety of studies to improve metabolic health, specifically the glycemic response. And we're now starting to get a few studies where they give people supplemental phytate and measure different health benefits. So we definitely need more studies there. But it looks like phytate may actually be nutritive, not anti-nutritive. Like, sure, it binds with minerals, but you know what? Our gut bacteria are so good at separating that for us so we can still absorb the minerals. Our gut bacteria process a huge amount of oxalates and phytates for us. So as soon as you actually look at, like, how does the whole food affect a whole human being and stop looking at one compound in the food in a petri dish or like inject that food into a rodent in a study, as soon as you look at the whole food and how it affects our total health, you see these foods are incredibly health-promoting foods. We can't judge a food just because it has a compound that in isolation might be harmful to one biological system. Just because something that might have a negative impact is present in a food, it doesn't mean that the amount that is present is harmful. It doesn't mean that it's harmful in the context of it was digested and then potentially broken down and then absorbed into our body. And it doesn't measure whether or not there's nutrients in that food that more than compensate for the presence of something that may be less desirable. And so all of the arguments for anti-nutrients really break down under scrutiny.
Yeah, you bring a good point about splitting hairs. I remember when eggs were off limits because they're dangerous. They increase your cholesterol. Well, science found that, you know what? That's true, but it contains lecithin and choline, which emulsifies cholesterol. And it's good. It's not going to increase your... You're right, because they cherry pick. Oh, it has cholesterol, therefore it's bad. And that's what you're saying with a lot of these fear-mongering is they're isolating one particular thing, looking, and yes, it's high in fructose and sugar, but look at the fiber it has. It's not going to spike your blood sugar. Don't look at the sugar. Look at the whole berry. The blueberry is good for you. It's got sugar.
That's a great analogy. It is very similar to the fear-mongering around cholesterol from the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. I like in your book, you share four essential nutrients. Yeah, you said like 90% of people are deficient in. What are these and why are so many people lacking them?
So vitamin D is the top. So 100% of people don't get enough vitamin D from their diet. And I kind of always feel like when we start with this list, we should maybe stick vitamin D in kind of its own little category because we do make some of our own in response to sunlight. So it is a nutrient that we can get from food, but we don't necessarily need to get it from food if we're getting enough exposure to the sun. So I always kind of like to stick a little extra like footnote on vitamin D because 100% not getting enough from our diets is maybe not the most important measurement. 75% of us have low or insufficient levels in our serum. That is more where vitamin D is like, ooh, we do need to be thinking about it. But 97.8% of people don't get enough potassium. Potassium is really important for regulating blood pressure. So as a result, it is really important in kidney health and cardiovascular health. It also helps to reduce the risk of osteoporosis to get enough potassium. 96.2% of American adults don't get enough vitamin E from their diet, which is our main fat-soluble antioxidant nutrient. And 90.2% of adults don't get enough folate, which is very important for reproductive health, very important for reducing spinal bifida, other neural tube defects. And so there's these four nutrients for which 90% or more of Americans don't get enough from our diets on a regular basis. There's another six where half of Americans are not getting enough from their diets. So we are in a situation where, statistically speaking, it's very unlikely that any one person is actually fully meeting their nutritional needs from the foods they eat. I kind of blame diet culture for this. I think that we have actually, over the last 50, 60, 70 years, been taught more wrong things about what a healthy diet looks like than right things by whatever, you know, trending diets have been out there.
Yeah. I've had patients come in with severe spasms, muscle spasm, and they're told by their doctor, stay away from potassium because it's bad for the kidneys. And I hear this more and more. And now there's some studies showing, no, it's not off limits. All these people, and like you just said, it's very commonly deficient is one of those that you mentioned. And a lot of them being told for the health of the kidney, stay off potassium. Don't do the bananas. Don't do the pumpkin
seeds. It's one thing if you already have kidney disease, right? And then you want to avoid overloading the kidneys because our kidneys, one of their jobs is to get rid of excess nutrients from when we consume a little bit more than we actually need. Our kidneys are great at filtering that out and making sure that exits the body. So it's one thing when you have kidney disease, there are definitely that math kind of, it changes a little bit, right? That's where you want to start avoiding excess protein too, right? There's other nutrients that you want to be careful of if your kidneys are already complaining. But if you have healthy kidneys, one of the best things you can do to keep them healthy
exactly.
is to make sure you're eating those high potassium foods.
Yeah, I had one says, well, you know, having kidney disease and potassium hurts the kidney, why is it not hurting a healthy kidney? That's the rationale. It's like potassium, bad for the kidneys. It's got kidney disease, it's bad. It's not a good way of thinking. So I'm glad you brought that up because for some reason, people are afraid to have potassium foods for their kidney. I'm like, good grief, all these freaking fear-mongering driving me crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
Let me ask you, now your book you talk about, interesting how most people following a healthy diet, they're still not getting enough nutrients. Share that because people hear the word healthy, they go, oh, I'm set. No worries. Why is that not true?
I think it's not true because we don't have the base knowledge to actually know what types of nutrients are in what types of foods. I think there's a couple of nutrients that are exceptions, right? People kind of have a general understanding you're getting vitamin C from fruits and vegetables, you're getting vitamin B12 from red meat. You're also getting a ton of vitamin B12 from shellfish. As soon as you kind of like expand that knowledge base a little bit and say, here's all the different places you can get this nutrient. I think that because we don't get this education in school, can you imagine if we graduated high school with the same sort of basic understanding of nutritional sciences as we have of algebra or grammar, just how different the landscape of public health would be? Because we would understand how to choose different foods to actually get all of the nutrients that our bodies need from the foods we eat, which is the Nutrivore dietary philosophy, but also just what good nutrition is. But we would also have that base knowledge to be able to identify diet nutrition misinformation online, and that would protect us from fear-mongering and predatory marketing. And it would just completely change how we talk about health and nutrition to just have that base knowledge. So even when we think we're following the rules, right? We're eating clean or we're following a diet that has been promoted to us for good health. It just takes a deeper level of knowledge to be able to actually meet our nutritional needs from the foods we eat. It's really easy to sort of accidentally avoid a collection of foods that just happens to be all of our best food sources of potassium, for example, or vitamin E, for example. It takes just that little bit more knowledge, but it's also one of the reasons why I've created a lot of resources to help make it formulaic for people while they're learning the knowledge, right? So that you can actually get started with, here's a better framework for choosing foods so that you're getting that full range of nutrients that your bodies need without having to worry about the details, so that learning about the details doesn't feel like we're cramming for an exam the night before.
Yeah, so true. I know another big controversial topic is wine, once considered heart healthy and a preventer of disease. Now it's considered unhealthy and toxic, even in moderation. Where does alcohol fit in for those following a nutrivore mindset?
I would definitely say the science is pretty solid now that it's sort of, scientists have gone back and sort of reevaluated a logical flaw in the studies from the 80s and 90s that led to that famous J-shaped curve where you saw benefits of moderate alcohol consumption. What scientists realized is they were comparing against the wrong thing. Their control at the time in these old studies were non-drinkers, right? People who didn't drink at all. And so if you compare to people who don't drink at all, people who drink one or two drinks per day appeared to have better health. But what they realized when they went back and reanalyzed that data was that the group of people who don't drink at all, overrepresented in that group was a large group of people who were told to not drink by their doctors for health reasons, right? Maybe they already had alcohol-related health problems like liver cirrhosis. Maybe they were diagnosed with cardiovascular disease and their doctors wanted them to stop drinking. Maybe they had alcohol use disorder. So there was all kinds of people in that control group who were sicker than average. So when you compared moderate drinkers to that group that was sicker than average, it made it sort of artificially look like one or two glasses of red wine per day was improving your health. But when you fix the control group and you instead compare against occasional drinkers, so people who don't really like drinking, but will have a glass of wine, you know, once or twice a month when their in-laws come over, whatever the reason is, you get rid of this like sick group of people in that comparison. And instead you're comparing against like a better control. And then you see one or two drinks per day, more like one for females and more like two for males, is health neutral. It's not that a drink a day is bad. It's just that it's no longer good. We now know that it was wrong to say that you have to drink, you know, one or two glasses of wine per day in order to reduce cardiovascular disease. Now we can say that's health neutral. Something that's health neutral can absolutely fit into an overall like health supporting eating pattern. You do other things that are going to reduce your disease risk. You absolutely can do some things that are health neutral, like absolutely. But we just don't want to like fool ourselves that one or two drinks per day is good for us anymore. We want to understand that's health neutral. And then our risk starts to go up after that.
Yeah. What about coffee? When I was in college, we were taught it was a disease causing. Stay away from it. I mean, it was the worst thing you could do, even cancer. Now it prevents disease. What do you say? Is it Java okay in the morning?
Yes, absolutely. I think coffee in moderation, there's more science showing that it's beneficial, but there's always exceptions to these types of rules. So for example, during pregnancy, it can increase some risks. There are some people who just are really sensitive to caffeine that have GI effects. They probably aren't benefiting from the polyphenols in coffee, but it does seem to reduce risk of, I think some of the most interesting science is like reducing risk of neurodegenerative disease. It does seem to reduce risk of type 2 diabetes. There does seem to be some legit health benefits. I think we want to be making sure that we are drinking coffee in moderation. So all of the studies showing benefit show benefit caps out at about 3 cups per day. And if we're drinking coffee too late in the day, we're starting to disrupt our sleep quality. That's going to affect our sleep patterns, and we're going to have far more harm from not getting enough sleep than we're getting benefit from drinking coffee.
So true. So basically, you're with the belief that I can let your body speak to you. And if you're jittery and you're nervous and your gut and you're on the toilet after coffee, probably not for you.
Or if you're tossing and turning all night, maybe like time to pull back a little bit at least.
Exactly. Let me ask you, with so many MDs focusing on prescribing medications to treat symptoms, I love how your book takes a different approach by highlighting how common ailments can stem from simple nutritional deficiencies. Can you share with us a few symptoms that might result in a lack of nourishment, symptoms that a prescription pill may cover up but can't fix?
I think one of the really tough things about nutrient insufficiencies, so a nutrient insufficiency is that weird gray in between I'm getting so little of this nutrient that it causes a disease of malnutrition versus I'm actually making, like getting what my body actually needs. So there's this weird amorphous gray land, which we call insufficient, where the symptoms of insufficiency are quite vague. So they're often things like fatigue, headaches, muscle cramps or joint pain, just generally feeling icky, not sleeping well, maybe having a slight tick up in depression and anxiety symptoms, right? There's a lot of these sort of vague symptoms that are really easy to explain away, right? It's really easy to say, oh, I didn't sleep well last night, or I feel this way because I have this big deadline, or because my boss is a jerk, or because my teenager's a jerk, right? Like whatever other, you know, stressful things that are happening in our life, it's really easy to just say, this is why I don't feel good. And we kind of adapt to not feeling great. We kind of just figure out how to push through. The challenge is that so many different nutrient insufficiencies can cause those vague symptoms that just feeling tired or having headaches a few times per week or having really bad PMS symptoms, it's really hard to say, here is the one nutrient that you must be deficient in, that you're not getting enough of, because every nutrient has multiple disease and symptom associations, and every symptom and disease has multiple nutrient associations. So understanding which nutrients are kind of linked to which conditions, like how getting more calcium can reduce PMS by something like 70%, which is a very large effect, how getting more magnesium can reduce the frequency and duration and severity of migraines. Like understanding those connections, I think, is really important. It's why I wrote about 27 of those connections in my book. But also, it's important to understand that extra layer of complication, that it's almost never just one nutrient. It's almost never, I just need more calcium and my PMS symptoms will go away. It's often the interaction between a lot of dietary factors. So while I think that explaining these connections is really important for making nutrition personal and for people understanding the role that a nutritional intervention can have in their health, not to say throw out your medications, but to say supplement, right? As a complementary approach. But it's also a great way of emphasizing why it's important to have a nutrient-focused diet, to be adding these nutrient-dense foods that help to fill in all of the nutritional gaps.
Time flew by. Is there anything else you'd like to share that we didn't cover today for the listeners taking notes? I'm assuming they're out there. I hear the pens and pencils.
I would just say, come follow me. My home base is Nutrivore.com, and I'm at Dr. Sarah Ballantyne across social media. And I create a lot of bite-sized nutritional sciences information so that you can learn in a fun fact kind of way. So I try to make learning the nutritional sciences that help us eat a healthy diet fun and lighthearted and always focused on nourishment and not judgment.
Fantastic. Fascinating, refreshing information. I want to thank you so much for joining us. The book is called Nutrivore, the Radical New Science for Getting the Nutrients You Need from the Food You Eat. To learn more and get your copy, go to Nutrivore.com. And while there, be sure and sign up for her free Nutrivore newsletter so you can stay up to date with all the latest. She also has healthy, nutrient-dense food recipes, guides. She got available webinars, all kinds of great information and resources on social media. Follow her on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at Dr. Sarah Ballantyne. I follow her, get a great tidbits every single day. You can follow me on Facebook and X at Dr. David Friedman. On Instagram, I'm at Dr. D. Friedman. If you heard something today that somebody you know needs to hear, send them a link to this podcast. It's available to goodhealthradio.com and radiomd.com, and peruse our podcast library. Share these segments of interest with friends, family, coworkers, and on social media. I always say sharing is caring. This information is too important. Don't keep it to yourself. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.